If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
Who I'm going to throw his name in as the new Pope.
Here we go. I'm in. Pope right. Jury the First.
I say we call it for you now, and then, you know, like when they announce their Pope, you're like, nope, sorry, we filled the position.
Called dibs. I'm sorry, folks. We already put our stank on it.
Beat them to the new Pope.
You know, I kind of feel like people haven't, don't really have a sense on just how wild that institution is and has had a history of being, the Vatican. Like, there's some wild stuff that's gone on there. Like, you know, and like some crazy hinky, like, oh, he's retiring, like kind of thing. Like, that's really not like... It's odd because I guess it's been oddly stable over the past, what, 200 years?
I don't think they've had a retiree like in 600 years or something.
Yeah.
I have a theory.
On why the Pope's gone. Oh, by the way, Brian's not going to be on the episode. We're not just doing a super elongated intro and waiting to get to him. He's traveling. So it's just us.
And he can't be the Pope because Justin gets to be the Pope.
Yes.
So the speculations around there, and I guess I off the top of my head, I think it was like, you know, again, the last thing I read was something like 600 years since you had a Pope step down before he up and died or died under mysterious circumstances.
Sure.
And I think that it was interesting is when they elected Pope Benedict was already pretty old because he's only been Pope for 6-7 years or something like that.
He was elected while I was, I think, junior in college, Cardinal Ratzlinger.
Yes. So he was 2005, so, you know, 7 years. Okay. Yeah. When he was elected, and it was interesting because there was this talk about, oh, are we going to get a, you know, a more liberal pope? Well, it is the Catholic Church.
Yes.
They want a really Catholic pope. And so, but there was talk that he was kind of a placeholder pope. They elected a guy who was already old and they knew wasn't going to stick around. I mean, it was going to maybe just up and die, you know, sooner than later. And that way, then they could like, oh, let's figure out who the hell we're going to have for a pope later on. But that was the talk because he was, you know, a much older guy than some of the other popes
so
have been.
You're thinking that there's a pope in waiting?
Maybe. It was, you know, the pope. Pope John Paul II was such a strong, charismatic figure. I mean, this was a guy that you look at what, you know, from the 25 plus years that he was Pope and the times that he saw from the Cold War, the fall of the Soviet Union, bringing Eastern Europe into the fold and all that, and the spread of Catholicism in parts of Africa and renewing the strengths in South America. So it was a big pivotal period of history this guy oversaw, and he was a very charismatic kind of guy and looking for the next, you know, guy. And he played a very prominent role on the world stage.
Yeah.
And I think when looking for the next Pope, they kind of look around like maybe there are people, maybe it was, I think, you know, like when they do their conclave to figure out who's next, it may have been, you know, we don't know, you know, maybe you want somebody younger, but they're like, let's not put a younger guy in there yet because we don't know who that is. Let's go, you know, with Ratzenberger,
yes,
and pick this guy because we know with him, yeah, you know, he ain't going to be around much. But here's my theory, and it's not a radical theory. I think that it's going to be talked about. Ratzinger, I always want to confuse him with the guy on Cheers, is what I think is part of the differences now is that in the age of television, in the age of everything, Your Pope is a guy that you're going to see on video a lot. And when you saw John Paul later on, the guy was very, very unsteady,
yeah,
and trembling, and that tends to be the thing with, you know, Benedict has been, you know, sure, clearly the signs of age are there. You don't want, you know, your Pope as a Pope, if you know that so much of your communication is visual and spoken, there's a concern in this age because that's how your message is getting out there. And I think he probably felt that he wasn't going to be able to communicate the message as well as he could. Years prior, you like, you know, hundreds of years, nobody's ever stepped down, but hundreds of years ago, you know, 50, 60 years ago, you know, it was letters. The papal communication was not like it was today, where he's like a video celebrity. And in the effort to, you know, prevent him from undermining and, you know, whatever kind of message he wants to get out there. And if he starts going through Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want a Pope up there who's, you know, starts talking about, you know, naming off his cats.
Sure. Yeah. Especially somebody who has the infallible voice of God at his disposal. You want to keep that line clear. So you would say that, I mean, that this is something where they want maybe somebody a little bit more virile and sure tongued and a little bit farther away from, you know, shaking with Parkinson's or something like that.
I think they want the same message. I think they're going to want somebody who is going to be a when you look at some of the most charismatic world leaders of the last 30, 40 years, Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
Okay. Desmond Tutu.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, certainly Pope John Paul II was one of those.
The Dalai Lama. Yeah, yeah, throw a little
Dalai Lama absolutely. When you and sticking to, you know, in this sort of that area, and then when you get into other world leaders like, you know, Bill Clinton and some of these people who are just in Ronald Reagan, these very, very strong type personalities.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be kind of a thing that comes into play.
That they wore power well, and for the Pope, that's a lot of power. You know, you have the head of the entire Catholic Church. That's a big bat to swing.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, the age of communication and how important that is. And when you look at your young people are increasingly turning away from that, and your largest growth comes from countries with high growths of population, but even that is starting to, as we see global population levels starting to level off, you look at this, you know, potential area of decline, it's, you know, we're gonna see the Twitter Pope.
There we go. The Follow Friday Pope.
Yes.
He's going to be out there just running hashtags, things I blessed today.
And it's, you know, you look at how long, you know, the papacy has been around, almost 2,000 years.
Whew.
It is a...
And again, folks, just go ahead. You want some interesting reading. Do a little history on the Vatican. It's been a wild place at times. It can get a little hairy up in the Vatican.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's fascinating because in many ways, it was an outgrowth of the power structure started by the Roman Empire in a way to sort of retain that power in a certain way. And you know, the long history of that and, you know, to where it is now and, you know, something that saw the an overthrown power that then moved on into another way and transitioned in something that just that old, 2,000 years in some respects isn't old, but in this respect, it's pretty damn old. And when you think about science fiction, you know, it's interesting. You watch, like, I've been watching some of these old Star Trek episodes.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the one where, you know, the Pope shows up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's background. I'm not really what you'd call religious, not Catholic or anything like that.
Sure.
But I have a feeling there's probably going to be a Pope 1,000 years from now.
Yeah.
Now, he may, you know, there may be just him and 800 followers in some ranch in Texas.
But yeah, I mean, like, that would be, it's hard for someone to say, like, well, it doesn't make sense to have a Pope. There's always going to be a reason to have a Pope, right?
Yeah.
There's always going to be a job.
Yeah, there'll be a Pope, you know, it's just always going to be a Pope. So I just think it's kind of interesting that, you know, a great science fiction book, A Canticle for Leibowitz,
uh-huh. It
kind of takes on that idea of what happens after, like, major global catastrophe and where religion goes. And it's an interesting topic and it's an interesting thing to think about, just the idea that this thing's been around 2,000 years before, it will be long after, and what it managed to survive through.
So what do you think, if you have one choice, if we're going to go into the assumption that there's a younger Pope, and obviously, like you said, as the head of the Catholic Church, you want a Catholic guy, there's not, Pope isn't going to roll in and say, congratulations, only gay people get to be clergy members. Like, like, it's not going to be anything crazy. But if you were to see the Vatican softening, or in the case of maybe, you know, some of the child sex stuff, like getting more aggressive on stuff under the tutelage of a new younger pope, what would be the area that you would guess you would see progress on?
Well, it's a hard thing. You know, the Vatican II, which was passed in the early 60s, which, you know, it's when people like Mel Gibson's father got pissed off and left the Catholic Church to do their own stuff.
Yeah.
Well, had a very humanizing effect on the church, yet was very, very much made concrete certain thoughts and ideals that they had. And I don't see that really deviating much. And you know, the latest pope will go on and, you know, spoken about the evils of communism and capitalism.
Yes.
And warning Catholics not to go to Protestantism. So, you know, it's Catholic for a reason.
Yeah.
And so as far as a, what I like to see, might soften up on, I don't know, the whole religion thing.
Yeah.
But I think that the church is so out of step with what causes prosperity is one of the problems. And when you have somebody who is, you know, critical of capitalism, yet you look at the poorest countries in the world and you look at what they don't have, property and property rights and the ability to create and build and do these things. And you look at what the most prosperous countries have and you go, what's different there? And the idea that, you know, charity is a very important idea, and you know, the church can understands the idea of redistribution, but the idea of how do you build these other countries up or these poorer people up is so alien to them, so alien to many people that didn't understand the real core idea of markets and stuff. I don't know. I really could not imagine, because it, once you start changing some of the core tenets is, you know, if they say, well, let's change our opinion on, you know, abortion, that's not going to happen. It's a Catholic church, you know, you know, on gays, that's not going to happen. And you
people
know,
freak out when like Republican presidential candidates aren't far enough on abortion. You know, I think, you know, the Pope is far beyond anybody who's running for the president of, you know, trying to seek the nomination of the GOP. So there's no way that's moving.
And the last Pope and the current Pope in the Vatican traditionally has been, with the exception of, you know, gay marriage and abortion, is very, very liberal, very, very, very liberal when you look at the economic policies and things like that. And so I don't see any of that changing.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're to say me, if I was brought in as a consultant to the Vatican, they're like, forget your weirdo ideas about, you know, people doing what's their own business and stuff and all that. What would you advise? I think that, you know, somebody who comes from the third world or has spent a considerable amount of time there would be helpful. Somebody who understands those kind of cultures would be better. It doesn't have to be any particular race or skin color or anything like that. I hate it when people go like, well, it should be blank. It shouldn't be this. No, it should be the right person for the job. And so whatever that be, you know, is it going to be, you know, somebody from Africa or South America, or somebody from New Zealand, who cares, whatever.
Yeah.
The point is that if I were, you know, the church and I wanted to sort of reach out to people, somebody who is charismatic, well-spoken, that you're going to put on CNN, and he's going to have an articulate, interesting discussion, multilingual, of course. I think that's going to be interesting. The guy that you can put on the news and talk, like the Dalai, you know, that can talk, and I think English would be, you know, a language he speaks well, just because that and Spanish are a very big part of
the world,
the Catholic domain. So I would say that. I think that that's the way to go. And somebody who's got you know, some sort of track record of advocacy or something. You have these places in Africa and South America where you've had people in the Catholic Church who've stood up for human rights in very, very strong ways. And somebody who has that kind of experience, I think would have a strong message, because that can overpower the negatives that a lot of young people feel today who have more progressive ideas. But if you have somebody who's like, listen, I stood up to this dictator, stood up here for human rights and did this, did that. It's like, all right, okay, you know what? I'll give you a pass on some of the other things.
Is there a happier man in the world today than Dan Brown?
Yeah, you could find out what Ewan McGregor is doing right now. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it was so, we only had, you know,
the last pope was just, you know, this pope was 2005. So he's been just around for such a short period of time. That,
yeah.
You know, it's we're just feeling like we just got to know the guy.
I feel like he was just there for the swag. Like he had an iPad, you know, got a Twitter account, a bunch of followers, and then he just cashes his chips. He's like, well, I don't know what. It's not going to get any better than this. I'm just out. Sorry, dudes.
He's like, yeah, no, the Episcopalians made me an offer.
Hey, listen, you can never be mad when somebody else makes you a better offer. It's been mad real.
So here's a fun question for you.
Go ahead.
Do you know who's qualified to be Pope?
Any cardinal?
Any Catholic male.
Really?
Don't even have to have been in the clergy. Any Catholic male can be Pope.
Now, I feel like I really do wish that Brian was on, because me and Brian had an idea for a movie treatment once. Because, you know, there hasn't been like a King Ralph, every man assumes the monarchy kind of movie in a while. And we thought the Pope, you do a-hole Pope, except we use the word for a-hole, starring Andrew Dice Clay.
Right.
Every man becomes Pope. This is it. We are experiencing the movie A-Hole Pope right now.
Yeah, but Clay is actually Jewish. So
he is, but that makes it all the crazier.
The character he plays. Gotcha. That's. Well, let me throw some famous Catholics at you.
Okay.
Liam Neeson.
Boom.
Mel Gibson. George Clooney.
Is Clooney?
Mark Wahlberg.
Say hello to your conclave for me.
Yes.
Jesus,
say hello to your mother for me.
Well, you know,
I think Gibson's up for it. I can tell you this, wouldn't be the worst pope we've ever had.
No, it wouldn't. It absolutely wouldn't.
Going back into historical precedent to
you want somebody who talks well in front of the camera. Easily the most charismatic pope in history. Mel gets elected. Without a doubt.
Drive around the Pope Mobile, no more DUIs.
Exactly. And by the way, even with everything you know that Mel Gibson has done to other people, alleged and confirmed, he still has a cleaner resume than most popes. But man, I'll tell you what though, I'm kind of, much as Mel, I think Mel, that would be a good, like, career thing. Like, obviously, like, the acting thing is just, he's tried to come back a couple times, it's just been really difficult. It gets harder and harder for Mel the person to get out of the way of Mel the actor, who is kind of universally sort of beloved. We all love Mel the actor. It's Mel the person that people kind of have a controversial view on. Let's just, Mel, what you really like to do is just get yourself out there. Boom. Pope, how would you like, I just want to try and sell that. I would like to think that right now, his agent is pitching him on this. Like, listen, we can totally figure this out. Arnold could be governor. Why can't you be Pope?
Arnold, by the way, was raised Catholic.
Wow. I'll tell you what. I still think Neeson, though, of the three, I feel like Neeson would be the most likely to be Pope. Like, he has a Pope kind of demeanor to him.
I have one more suggestion. I gotta do the research on this. Yeah, I was gonna say, like, the easiest sell would have been if Ryan Gosling was actually, you know, Catholic, but raised Mormon, actually.
Oh, man. What's the head of the Mormon church?
They have like a bishop or something.
Big dog. Big dog Mormon. Yeah, I feel like, you know, Neeson, you can see out there on the balcony, he's giving the speech. It's kind of even keel, but inspirational. He's talking about the light of Christ, like, and it's really, like, surprisingly tough and badass. And you're like, no, this is the dude that I, and also I feel like Neeson's frame supports that hat the best.
Yeah.
He's got it. You know, he's a big, you know, although, I mean, because with Arnold, I feel like the shoulders would make the hat look even stupider than it already does.
Yeah, I think Neeson would just sell. And I think Neeson could bring some people into the Catholic fold.
I mean, listen, like you said, you're not a religious guy. How much more likely would you be to at least listen to the papal speeches, the papal decrees, if Liam Neeson was the Pope?
You know, in the right role, he's a fantastic actor. You might have me start questioning things. Maybe I've been too dismissive, you know? This guy wasn't Taken, you know?
Absolutely. If you're looking for money, I now have that because I'm the head of the Catholic Church. Who is your last ditch effort?
Hold on. Let me pull up this name here. I was hoping, you know, the one I was hoping for, but he's not, he's Protestant, and like his father was actually, or grandfather was a reverend, would have been great. Because we could tell him it was a role and he would think that it was just an acting role, but he would take it with such seriousness. Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Well, you know, the question is, you know, you could, the good thing with Daniel Day-Lewis, right, is he's kind of a skeleton key. You can just kind of plug him in like, hey, we need rambunctious Pope, and he'll study for a couple of years. Next thing you know, the white smoke comes out. We have rambunctious Pope. We need staid, solemn Pope. Boom. He puts the work in. He comes out. He's absolutely, you know, dry as paint. No matter what, Daniel Day-Lewis is going to take it to the woodshed.
Oh, I got one for you.
Go ahead.
I got one for you. Apparently born Catholic.
Okay.
Make a great Pope. I mean, would be a believable Pope. I mean, would make a charismatic.
Without revealing the name, what's the single best attribute of this new Pope?
He like exudes awesomeness in just like every capacity.
So a fun, a magnetic Pope, a charismatic Pope, somebody that you want to be around and listen to.
Yeah, you'd want to be this Pope.
What would be the biggest red flag with this new Pope?
The biggest red flag with this new Pope would be that he might be so identified with some of his characters that the idea of married, but if his like wife dies or passes away sadly or whatever, he could be, or you know, you can, you know, kind of move on to the papacy, I believe, from there. So the biggest red flag would be I think, you know, women are attracted to this guy. You'd find it hard to think like, you know, he's you know, that ain't gonna happen. But he's older now, so.
So maybe a bit too much of a ladies' man.
He never had an outward reputation for that. And there aren't a whole lot of stories or any stories I'm aware of him. There's certainly women attracted to him, but to my knowledge, he doesn't have the sort of stories of being kind of a player like other people have been.
I think I got it.
Go.
Is it one Mr. Sean Connery?
Boom.
There we go. Sean Connery, the Pope. He doesn't want to act anymore. Yeah. You know, he's just sitting around in Scotland somewhere with his kilt.
Of the Bahamas now, actually.
Oh, the Bahamas. He's living in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. I feel like Sean could be into this. I feel like we could talk Sean in. I don't know why we're talking Sean into it. I don't know why we have to call him up and sell him on why the Pope, why the papacy is right for him. Yeah, now, how do you do it? Do you like get nominated? Does somebody have to, you know, like say your name three times in the big Pope room?
Well, they have the conclave where all the head bishops, the cardinals, get together and they decide. They do their the
rock, remember, like paper, the white scissors smoke tournament.
What's that?
They do the rock paper scissors tournament to determine who is the new Pope.
Well, and they do the papal conclave, and so you get the College of Cardinals, which gets together, and so. It is, and now I'm pulling up the Wikipedia. So that's to elect the Bishop of Rome, which also comes with, that's the Pope.
The Pope, sure.
You know, Commander Chief, President. So the College of Cardinals, that's where like they all get locked in there and they don't get a couple leave until they you know, the white smoke's the only communication they have.
Yeah.
Or black smoke or white smoke.
So. Yeah, black smoke is that they've taken a vote and they have not come to a decision. right? Or a conclusive decision. And then white
smokes. Yeah, white smokes, we got a decision.
Yeah, we're poping it up, baby.
Yeah.
And so I guess at that point, someone can just roll in. All you got to do is sell one cardinal, right? On being like, listen, this is going to sound crazy, but have you ever seen James Bond? Not the new one, the older ones.
Yeah.
And then another cardinal's like, but what about Daniel Craig? I don't know if he's Catholic.
He's Protestant. He's Protestant. Yeah. He's Protestant.
Okay. Now all I want to know is how many of the Bonds could be Pope.
Well. let's see. Brosnan's Irish, so.
I feel like Brosnan's got a shot.
Let's see. Let's see. Roger Moore doesn't strike me as Catholic. No. What do I know? Pierce Brosnan talks about his deep Catholic faith.
Boom. He's already laying the resume right there.
It's a handsome pope.
Tell you what, he's calling it 00 heaven.
Yeah. Let's see. Roger Moore, looking up Roger Moore here to see if he what his background is.
Roger Moore would be a dark horse. I feel like if you're going to rank them, I feel like Connery and Brosnan are your two big horses in the run for the Vatican.
And I don't see anything here out of him. It would surprise me if he was Catholic. But the thing about him, I'll give to his credit, he's done a lot of stuff with UNICEF. He's actually like a pretty out there good guy with
big charity guy, right?
Yeah, helping kids and that kind of stuff. So he's got the humanitarian sort of side to him.
Well, all right. So let's run him down real quick. Let's have him face, the problems. Brosnan and Connery. Who do you think tackles this child sex problem in the Catholic Church with more effectiveness? Connery or Brosnan?
Connery did a movie called The Offense where he plays this police officer who basically like kills or nearly kills a sex offender, a child molester.
Boom. Yeah. Boom. So. Imagine that. All right. All of a sudden, some guy falls under scrutiny. There's a lot of whispers around the church. Normally in the old Catholic Church, he's just going to get moved from one to the other one. Next thing you know, the DVD, just Amazon, just arrives in the mail. And it's like, care of the Vatican. Just straighten up, buddy. It's in the old Catholic Church no more. There's a new Bishop of Rome in town, and his name is Connery.
So, I don't know what Lazenby is. I think he's whatever you want him to be.
I feel like we got it. I feel like we sewed it up. Although I think we're leaning heavily on Irish and Scottish people.
So, I think I'm going to go with Connery. Brosnan's my second.
Yeah, no, I'm in. I'm all in with Connery. I think he's our Bond. It's about time we entrusted the Catholic Church to somebody who is a proven results getter, James Bond.
Solved.
So what else is going on, buddy?
Let me pull up. So I'll tell you what's going on. You know what's happening end of this week?
What is happening at the end? Oh, is it our close shave?
That's right.
An asteroid playing a little sweet chin music with old planet Earth?
Asteroid 2012 DA14 will approach within 17,000 miles of Earth. Now, to give you an idea of how close that is, we have satellites further out. The moon's 225,000 miles away. This is 17,000 miles away, all right?
Yeah.
So it's going to fly within the orbits of a lot of our satellites. That's close. That's really, really close.
Now, the thing that fascinated me the most about reading this is that this is something that will continue to orbit around the Earth, right? That it's in or it's not like going to go spin off somewhere. It might come zip back around. I mean, obviously hundreds of years from now, but like,
Yeah, it's going to have a return, and you know, at this point, we're going to calculate how far out it's going to be the next time around, because there's, you know, it's one of those things we have this, the probability of it coming closer, the probability of impact. And now it's 150 feet across, half a football field. It's not a dinosaur killer.
No,
yeah, it's you know, this thing hits. It's, you know,
depending on where. Event. You know, yeah,
it could be, it could be like Tunguska in Siberia, which, yeah, it hits a city. That city's screwed. That city's absolutely screwed. But if it were to hit, you know, again, not going to hit this time. Don't panic. Not that anybody's panicking by now, but it's next time around, you know, 150 foot across rock. I think next time it comes around, we could probably handle it.
Well, here's my question. Why don't we try shooting at this thing now? Why don't we, I don't know. Let's whiteboard this problem. We got an asteroid flying around. At some point, it's going to be a major problem for us.
Are you saying like between now and Friday?
Well, I mean, like, listen, okay. I'm not saying that we had to do something this time. I'm saying maybe we look back and say we could have been thinking about things to do. We could have been polishing up some of those nukes to throw up into the atmosphere and try to kill this thing.
Yeah, there are people working on those contingencies.
But I'm saying, like, hey, listen, ain't nothing but live target practice.
I just, you know, my fear is this. I think that we need to be mindful of all the different things that affect us, from pollution, you know, our influence on our environment, all these things. And then, you know, you start listing off the big things, you know, 500,000 children die each year from malaria. That's a pretty big deal. That's a pretty big deal. And, you know, if you ask me what would be my priority out of it, I'd be like, let's solve malaria first and let's move on to these other things. Then when we get out to the problems that are going to affect us 60 or 70 years out, I'm not as worried about those things.
Yeah.
Asteroids are kind of a big thing. Asteroids are kind of a big deal. And you know, we know that they hit the Earth. We know that's happened before. We know that when they do hit, it can be a pretty big deal. We've got all the ones that we think are the dinosaur killer type ones tracked, as far as we know. We have a pretty good idea where those are. But something like this gets through and hits, it's a pretty big impact. Is it going to be, you know, any more devastating than, you know, the worst earthquake you get in a year? I don't know. I don't know. But I certainly think that, you know, I would rather us spend some of this focus looking into this problem than, you know, yelling at me because I like to drive with my air conditioner on.
Sure. Yeah. No, number one, I agree with you. I'm signing your petition, mister, in that I think that is a bigger problem. So what are the most likely solutions to asteroid is hitting the Earth right now? What is in our theoretical toolkit in the Armageddon scenario?
The further out it is, the easier it is to deflect it, because any amount of force you put on it will have some effect on its orbit. If it's way the far enough, and you'll hear these things like, oh, you know, all we need to do is paint them, you know, and make one side black so it absorbs. Like, yeah, that works great when it's really, 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 really far out.
Yeah.
You know, in disaster scenarios where you find out you've got 3 months before the thing hits, that ain't going to help you.
No.
And
also, it's not a plan that inspires confidence amongst the populace who is worried about extinction. Don't worry, everybody. We've gone to Lowe's.
We got this. They even mixed it for us. So you have different things. They have gravity tractors, which is the idea of you put some other kind of heavy, massive object there, which will change the orbital path. And again, you'll hear people like, oh, you know, all we have to do is the X. And again, we've had people tell us in the show before when we talk about asteroids, like, oh, just paint it or do gravity tractors. Like, yeah, those things are great when it's 8 years away and it's not that massive. You know, when all that'll do is, it's instead of hitting the middle of Minneapolis, it's going to hit 5 meters to the side because we put that paint of coat on it.
Sure.
Too late. So what you need to do is, you know, you have to figure out how far it is and what you can do. And ideally, you have detection. You have the ability to detect it much further out. And that's the thing that we can spend a lot of money on now. If we want to spend money on things that can wipe out our planet, you know, you know, asteroids are much more likely than anything else. You know, life on our planet's never died because it got hotter. Okay.
Yeah.
Life dies on our planet because photosynthesis shuts down because it gets too cold, or, you know, you can't see sunlight. So if you say asteroids, there we know a lot of times, a lot of evidence that's destroyed life. So if we want to spend money on detection, that's a great thing to look into, because the further out you can spot these things, the better data you have and the better things you can plan. Because if you know how far out it is and it's way the hell out there and you can do something early on, then yeah, you know, a little nuke, you know, pineapple grenade, paint it, whatever. But when you find out this thing's 6 months away,
yeah,
you're kind of doomed.
You're screwed.
Yeah.
And of course, that's what, I mean, it always seems when everybody, you know, especially with, you know, film dramatizations of this kind of problem, like Armageddon or Deep Impact, when all of a sudden, like, well, I guess Deep Impact, we knew it was coming and the state kept it secret. And then yeah. Armageddon, it just kind of snuck up on us. And Billy Bob Thornton was very, very upset about that. You know, people always are like, oh, well, you know, like we would know that, the, you know, that there was something out there. And like, as much as like that, yeah, sure. From everything that we know now, absolutely. We're tracking everything that we think is out there that could have that kind of effect. But it's like, isn't our history just kind of rife with things that we don't know kind of happening and biting us in the ass?
Well, the problem is that it comes down to how when you spot an object, you have a computer, you have computers that tell you like, okay, we think that it's going to, you know, we know this thing's going to miss us by 17,000 miles.
Yeah.
And there are objects out there that, and we know this because people with big computers said this is the calculation. And so you could spot something in heaven. If you wanted to have a conspiracy, you would have the, you know, the most vocal government would be out there saying, no, it's, you know, 98.9999% chance it's going to miss us. Well, they know, no, really, it's a 30% chance it will hit us or whatever. That would be where the conspiracy could come from, because that data is, you have to, it's an amount of trust. And I think that, you know, if we knew it was going to hit, people would talk or something. So I don't worry about that.
No, that would be a pretty, the whistleblower on that would get a pretty warm response from the world. Be like, hey, we're going to get hit by a meteor and it's going to affect a lot of people. Like that guy gets a warm response.
But does he? Okay, let's assume, like, I think that if any potential crisis or whatever, the government can mobilize a lot of resources and, you know, that they're eager to jump on that opportunity.
Yeah.
I would say that, but if for some reason they wanted to kind of hide this or sort of delay this or whatever, the guy that comes out and says, hey, look at this, he's going to be discredited. Or she, you know, they're going to be.
Sure. I mean, I guess it would be dependent on him or her being right and the ability for us to verify with the information that they are pointing to on a general
level. That's where it gets tricky. And you're going to have universities and other people going to look at that. And that's the neat thing about this sort of data is you have a lot of telescopes in this world, and the more telescopes, the better. And you have a lot of independent parties that look at this stuff and are going to say, hey, and if you get a couple other parties are saying, you know, the University of San Paulo is saying, hey, you know, we're not getting the same orbital track that they're getting. This something doesn't jibe up. And then Japan says, yeah, this seems kind of bogus. And that's why a lot of these conspiracy theories, you got to pull everybody in to do it. And, you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's weird. You know, it's kind of in some ways it's laughable that people think that we didn't land on the moon, because when you want to, when you have, you know, every government in the world was doing using telemetry and whatever to track, you know, what was going on there, it would have been utterly impossible to keep that a secret. You know, if the Soviets could prove that we didn't do it, they would have loved to have pointed out, or the Chinese would love to have said, hey, they faked it.
Yeah. No, that would, I mean, that's, you know, I think, funny enough, the last time I had heard, listen, we launched a rocket into the sky and we had a lot of other countries that were not friendly to us watching the sky. If we did not actually do that, that would be something that they would know, you know, and they would have no compunction in blowing us up. It was actually, I think it was Jack Black, like as Jack Black's parents were part of NASA or were involved in NASA during the moon launch or whatever, the first moon exploration. And he gets very defensive about that, or at least he did on one of the podcasts I was listening to him on.
Yeah. And you have, and there's that, and there's also, you know, because like they're quite like the Grassy Tyson says, well, you know, like where would the rocket go? Because you had all this fuel. Like, well, you could conspiracy theorist mind, you could say, well, it went up, it went into orbit, they painted it black or something like that. Fine. You know, I mean, yes. you know, never discount the ability for somebody to come up with an untestable hypothesis on what happened. But the thing that's kind of interesting to me is when you had the telemetry of the return of the Apollo crew coming back down, they were going ridiculously fast. They were going at the velocities that would only come back from coming from a, you know, leaving lunar orbit.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my question would be like, if you're looking at that data of how fast this thing is going, you have to ask yourself, where did this come from?
Exactly. Is it a heretofore unknown rocket booster that we have kept completely secret?
And it, we somehow managed not to see ignite. So you get to this point.
And by the way, if we have the heretofore unknown rocket booster, why don't we actually just use it to go to the moon? That,
exactly. Is you get to like, well, there was a rocket and the rocket launched. And yeah, maybe it went into lunar orbit, but and then it came back. But then like, we don't think it actually they landed. And you're like, all right, you get into all these kind of does it just get kind of easier just to put some goddamn guys on the moon?
Sure. All right. I want to talk to you about conspiracies real quick, because I've noticed something over the last week. And I guess in our post YouTube era, we should just kind of get used to, you know, the bigger the tragedy, and specifically ones with political ramifications, we're going to see the loose change style 13 minute mini documentary that just asks questions about, quote, I'm using air quotes, just ask questions about a big tragedy. Because most recently, you know, I've seen friends of mine on Facebook, or more specifically, sisters of friends of mine, or people that aren't particularly smart, talk about this. Are you aware of this Newton, the Sandy Hook conspiracy theory video that's going around? It's just like, it's crazy to think that this, I mean, I guess like this element of conspiracy is just going to be something that we're always, you know, going to deal with. Right. Like, I mean, I guess it's always been there. It's just with YouTube. Now it has this kind of form.
I think that. Yeah. And it's important to understand sort of the roots of a lot of these conspiracy theories. And some of them, a lot of the ones of late come from people feel disenfranchised.
Yeah.
People feel powerless. And then there is like in the era of loose change, et cetera, there's this idea that people don't want to believe that bad things happen. They want to believe that the only bad in this world is this really orchestrated thing by the powers that be, because some of these people are very, very frightened by the idea that a individual or a small group of people can do horrific things like 9/11, or one guy can walk into, you know, Newton and do these things. And that is a very disturbing thing for a lot of people to realize. They cannot wrap their head around the idea that, yes, there are bad, really, really bad people in this world that aren't smoking cigars in rooms and twirling their mustaches and stuff. The guy down the street could be crazy enough to go off and do this. And that scares the hell out of people. And they will do anything they can rationalize to say, no, this was part of something much, much bigger. It was some bigger, more orchestrated thing, because they cannot deal with the idea that evil can just pop up out of nowhere like that.
And I mean, I guess, is it something... I always have a bit of a weird reaction to it, because like I want to yell at or about it, but at the same time, I don't want to draw attention to it.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that does just kind of think that this is, in its own weird, perverse way, as much as I kind of find the fruits of it abhorrent, it is just a natural element of people trying to see patterns where there are not patterns. You know, they're trying to make order out of chaos.
And they want to make themselves important in their worldview. The idea that I see the truth, I see what's going on here.
Wake up, sheeple!
And it also ties into there is this that and the idea that a lot of people who seem to have the most time to spend on these things don't have a lot else going on in their lives, and that in a lot of these all sort of tie into, and this is why I can't get ahead. In some strange way. And not to say that, you know, there is all questions and things like that, I think are, if you're somebody who is knowledgeable about certain things, is certainly worth saying, okay, let's hear what has to be said. Let's do this. But again, you know, the caution on that is that you get people who I have, you know, when 9/11 happened, you know, I have people explaining to me things about metallurgy and ballistics and aeronautics that don't understand basic fundamental science. Somebody told them this, and now they know this to be true.
Yeah.
And what they weren't reasoned into, they can't be reasoned out of. And that's the problem you get into here. But nonetheless, it is important that we have, you know, part of our society, you know, pay attention to these things, because, you know, we don't want to get into a position where, you know, we just sort of become too passive. But of course, the answer to that is just healthy skepticism, not believing every counterpoint of view.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, you know, I at the end of the day, though, it's so frustrating. And you know, it just, you kind of, at least when I watch, you know, any bit of it that I can watch, or watch people talking about it, or watch people kind of spreading it around, you know, I very much believe that you need to have views out there that aren't your own. And it's not the worst thing in the world for people to say things that even you might know passionately are wrong, or even to some certain extent, you know, you believe to be damaging on an organizational level, if not an active level. But when it comes to questioning the pain and motivation of victims like 9/11 or the Sandy Hook thing, it really personally gets my goat.
Yeah, and there is a place for skepticism that does not require you to be that insensitive or inhumane. And that's the thing that frustrates me, is that there are ways to say, hey, I don't know if I understand this fully, which you'll never hear somebody will say. You know, they'll say, you know, and when people start speaking with absolute certainty and conviction, and you know, what am I certain and convinced about? I think there's an absolute reality. I think my ability to interpret and understand it is flawed. That's what I'm certain about. You know, I have very strong opinions on a number of things, but these are opinions that facts will change my beliefs and not vice versa. And when somebody is in a position where, you know, when they start throwing you that whole salad bowl full of all of these arguments and you pick one up, you know, and you're like, well, this is not true. There's this thing. And then, but it's like, and you want to kind of go like, wait a second, you know, this was an easily debunked thing, easily bunked. You could have found out that was not true, yet you were holding on to this. Why? Because you did not use skepticism, because you did not take the time to try to criticize your own arguments, because it was a matter of belief for you.
Well, if you look at even like the YouTube structure, the most popular videos that you're going to find of a certain ilk are the ones that generate the most debate, that people are asking questions and pointing things out, or, you know, flaming, you know, a point. And these kind of videos that are highly controversial or highly provocative, I think you could easily say that this is a very provocative idea that they are throwing out there, no matter how, you know, ridiculous or fact challenged it might be, is just bait for people to correct them, debunk the arguments, that makes the video more popular. It gets spread around as people talk about it. And then they make a sequel that says, well, okay, these were debunked, but how about all these other questions?
Yeah. And it's in both sides. There was an XKCD cartoon, which was great. It was about it was YouTube in the age of this stuff. And let me pull this up, because it's absolutely relevant to this. XKCD, for those of you who don't know, go to xkcd.com, and it's these little stick figure commentaries that they're hilarious. Sometimes they're like, they're so smart that like you have to, you know, Wikipedia. It's not me. I get every single one.
Of course. Andrew does. Yeah. I have to Wikipedia everything.
I wanted to put like a little like a plug-in for your browser in case you didn't get it. You press the button and it would pop up an extra panel, which would just be a stick figure having gas. so you could turn every single one of those jokes into a fart joke. You know, because it could be because sometimes the joke is some like advanced mathematical equation that you look at like, I don't know. But then if it ended in a fart joke, you'd be like, I get it.
Look at that.
All right. So
I feel like, who does XKCD? Because I feel like I've read so much XKCD, but I don't know that guy's name, and I feel like I should.
So go to xkcd.com/202. Mm-hmm. And it's a, it shows the headline is, the internet has always had loud, dumb people, but I've never seen anything quite as bad as the people who comment on YouTube videos. And the commentary there just wonderfully kind of shows how you get somebody saying something stupid, but then you get somebody who maybe supports your point of view, but not based on any facts whatsoever. No. And, you know, it starts off, you see the photo, you know, it looks like it's a YouTube of the guy on the moon. And then it says, Roxer says, this is so obviously faked. It's unbelievable, poorly spelled. Why are people so gullible, morons? And then the next one says, I've seen a space shuttle ass. It's definitely landed on the moon. Do some research.
No, that is absolutely hilarious. And XKCD, just fantastic. Just a glittering gem. Randall Monroe. That's the name that I should know and you should know too. Randall Monroe is the man who does XKCD.
Yeah, that's quite brilliant. So I think that we're absolutely going to see more of that. How long do these things hold our attention spans? Yeah, I don't know. And there are people, there are always going to be people who are going to be obsessive stuff. And before the internet, I remember, you know, the trilateral stuff, the Rothschilds, all these sort of conspiracy
Rothschilds
theories.
Are coming back in a big way, man. I've heard the Rothschilds talked about because I think Alex Jones.
The Red Shield. Yes.
Yeah, he's a big Rothschild guy.
And you get the new ones. It's, you know, and it's funny because it's like in every group, it's like, oh, the Koch brothers this, the Koch brothers that. And, yeah. You know, and it's, you know, they're a group of people that want to protect their interests and stuff. But any discussion of them is not going to mention the fact that they spent $500 million on cancer research or, you know, millions of dollars to the ACLU. Just forget that, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, it's amazing to me how one group will lambast another group because of their conspiracy theories and stuff like that. Yet in their own way, will start weaving these very elaborate. Well, you know who your real masters are.
Exactly.
It's like, all right. Everybody settle down. So, quick side note, I will, and now for the conspiracy, I believe, and we talked about this a while ago, and I just want to do sort of an update on it. Remember NASA did the release, said, hey, we think we found life that uses arsenic in DNA.
Yes.
So what's kind of curious is that paper came out. And if you read the actual NASA press release that NASA put out when that happened, and you can still find this on the website for a NASA website. And again, I love NASA. I love NASA. Okay, I don't want to come across at all as
anti-NASA.
I think they do some great things, but like many organizations, they're a large organization, and sometimes the people trying to promote the mission of NASA, get ahead of themselves. So if you type in NASA arsenic-based life, you'll still find the press release. NASA-funded research discovers life built with toxic chemical, okay? And it speaks in a very definitive, this is what we found, is that we found this bacterium, this microorganism that uses arsenic in its DNA, which was a very, very exciting, fantastic piece of research.
And that kind of got kicked around a little bit. Right.
Yeah, it is to the point, and this came out 2 years ago. And if you follow up now, all the subsequent research that I've been able to, I mean, it's pretty much established bogus. It was poorly, and not by any malevolent intention of anybody in there. Probably what some people say was just inadequate research. It was, and some people say sloppy, whatever. Even when it came out, there was this debate about there's a problem.
I remember a very vociferous debate about how thorough they had been in understanding what this claim that they were making, and even like what had come like before and what people had found in terms of, you know, life forms, with any kind of toxic, you know, makeup at all. Right.
Yeah. And so I would say that it's been fairly well debunked.
Sure.
And the problem was, is several fold is when they first, NASA had this, there was these rumors, NASA was going to have this press conference, very, very, very big thing coming out, possibility of life. And people are thinking, man, you know, where are our probes right now? We found something on on one of the Saturn moons or whatever. There's excitement. Like, holy, you know,
sure.
Like life, NASA life. You think NASA life, you're not thinking some acidic lake somewhere. You know, you're thinking, you know, well, you are, but not on our planet. And then when it's like, hey, guess what? This is what we found. And it was, the idea was an exciting idea. We think we found life that uses arsenic, okay, instead of phosphor in DNA. And like, whoa, that's kind of a big deal, because that means that you could have, you know, a different, totally different form of life. You could build DNA from different materials than what we thought you could, which would mean that life could be in even more places. Okay.
Sure.
But instead of, well, and then as we pointed out, research has now shown that it looked like experimental problems, that was not the case, that the phosphorus, or, you know, that the DNA in this organism was using phosphorus, wasn't using arsenic, it was just a bad paper. But the problem was, is NASA did a big press release. They came out with this, a whole big press conference announced these results, and a lot of people were saying it was premature. And now, a couple years later, the idea is pretty well debunked. But yeah. The problem is, if you go to the NASA website, it's still up there.
Huh.
Okay, you go to, they're still up there. Not that they need to pull that, but they should perhaps do
an addendum
or something to it. They should say, hey, let's pull this up. And if you go to that website, it's nasa.gov. And you go to, you find up that press release, and then they say, for more information, go to astrobiology.nasa.gov, okay? And you type in arsenic into the search box. You're going to get, I think, two instances. You're going to get two articles, okay? You get the original paper that came out, or you get several articles, but you get the original paper that came out and about the, you know, saying that, you know, the role of arsenic in microbial physiology. And then you get one other, the first paper that comes up is just the paper that it says, hey, guess what? We can't verify this, but it's not a NASA study, it was somebody else.
Yeah.
So my question is that should they be doing more to, you know?
Well, I mean, I guess the question would be relative to their credibility, NASA's credibility, and, you know, how seriously they expect us to pay attention the next time something like this happens, right?
Right.
You know, it's like, sure, they can do whatever they want, you know, but their actions are going to be what we remember the next time that they cry wolf, for lack of a better term.
And you know, and it could be, you know, science is ongoing. There could be more research forthcoming, whatever. But I just thought that, you know, you go look at that article there and you don't see anything to say on NASA's behalf to say, yeah, you know what, maybe, you know, check out this other paper which says, and that's what the scientific process should be. And science worked here. Science worked itself. Science worked wonderfully.
Sure.
Other people, somebody made a claim, other people together. The problem is the PR machine and the press and the hype machine came into play and blew this way out of proportion. And that was, you know,
didn't NASA also get a little defensive on this, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, there was actually a little bit of a snarky sort of back and forth on that, which was
not particularly helpful. I think we can all agree.
Yeah. And so in any event, I just brought that up because, you know, on the subject of keeping, you know, more information is good. I'm always skeptical. I'm always concerned when I go to a site that says these other people are wrong. So wrong, I'm not even going to link to what they're having to say.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, willingness to link makes it you're right, but when you are just so trying to control the narrative of what people you're talking to the point that you will not point them towards other points of view.
The other thing that you are rebutting, you know, and just trust that everybody reading that you are quoting them accurately or quoting them, you know, not selectively to just make your point and misrepresent what they're saying.
Yeah. All right, sir. Another topic, you want to do picks?
I think we're ready for picks here.
All right. I'll let you go first.
Oh, man. I'll tell you what. You know, I think I'm going to go with something that I have not yet listened to, but I did download. And that is a pick that, Andrew, I believe it was yours a little while ago. The audio dramatization of Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Which I downloaded, and you know, I've always got a few audiobooks here in the hopper, but I'm very excited to get into that. Oh, also, let me also give a pre plug there to see Robert Cargill. He's a friend of NSFW show. His first book, Dreams and Shadows, is coming out later this month, I believe the 28th. Many might remember him as Massaworm on AintItCoolNews.com. But he's someone, I mean, Andrew actually turned me on to AintItCoolNews.com. I mean, no, God knows how many years ago. and it's been a site that I've visited, you know, nearly daily, you know, pretty much every day since then.
If you want somebody to tell you what the latest news is on Latino Review and superhero hype, go to Ain't It Cool News.
You know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, as the site has kind of gone through its various permutations, and it is, I think it's safe to say, not exactly as vibrant as it once was.
When people knew what the reference for Ain't It Cool was from.
Yes, Jesus.
Remember what that was from?
From Broken Arrow, right?
Yeah.
Ain't It Cool?
Cool.
But yeah, it's Cargo's a really, really cool guy. He was on the last episode of NSFW show. Go ahead. His book is available now, Dreams and Shadows. Go pick that up.
Broken Arrow. How much does this hurt? It is a 1996 American action film.
Oh, yeah, man.
I mean, that's let me give you, but I always like to compare it. It's like this to this. So that's almost like, you know, in another year or so, it'll be like saying in 1996, a Taxi Driver reference.
Yeah, no, it's it was a little while ago. Yeah. That was, yeah, Travolta fresh off the career reinvigoration with Pulp Fiction, you know, is on top of the world, big A-list star again, and he does the old Rogue Nuke action movie. That was Slater, right?
What's that?
Who is
Christian Slater? Yeah.
Yeah. Christian Slater and an old John Travolta.
Directed by Mr. John Woo, as you said.
And I would eventually, I will have a, I have the reason why I am poorly read for this edition of Picks is because I have been reading something else that I won't talk about until later. But let's say theoretically, it's a book written by somebody else on this podcast, and I won't name who, no matter how much you tickle me.
I wonder who. Okay, my pick. I resisted this. I resisted this fully knowing that once I gave into it, I'd probably really be into it. But I resisted on a matter of sort of principle, and also admit that I had some of my facts wrong. It's hard to believe.
Okay.
But at any event, it doesn't change the emotional reason that I had for one of the reasons for resisting this, but nonetheless.
Because I remember specifically, I know where you're going, and I remember specifically your reaction to the news that this was going to be a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things I went to retrace, like, how did I get that part wrong? How did I? I was wrong. But anyhow, that's not important. Netflix, as many of you know, everybody knows on the planet, has remade the British series House of Cards.
Yeah.
House of Cards originally did in 1990. Let me see what this was. I want to say like 92, but it felt UK, 1990. Okay. And that was on Netflix for the longest time. And I'll go through periods just rotating through miniseries and stuff. And I watched the original House of Cards a while ago, and I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. The ending I always had sort of an issue with, because it was just a sort of it was based on a trilogy of novels by a person who's pretty well placed in the British in Parliament. He was actually a Conservative Party leader who worked with Margaret Thatcher, and who was a very, very well in the know guy who wrote this really cool inside baseball series of books about a character who's sort of Machiavellian personality. And the TV series was pretty good. I enjoyed the TV series. My biggest problem is that I just sort of the emergent hero sort of saves the day. I go, wow, that's really messed up.
Well,
but
yeah, let's get your recommendation. But then can we tack on a spoiler addendum? Those, like, the podcast will end, and then you can discuss the spoilery element of why you disliked the original House of Cards.
We'll do that. Okay. So anyhow, the recommendation is the House of Cards. It is produced by David Fincher, who's directed a couple of the episodes, starring Kevin Spacey. He plays the whip, the party whip for the DNC. And the party whip, for those of you who don't know, he's the guy that when you have a bill come up, he's the guy that goes and finds the votes, just twists arms, gets people to show up, does the count. He's the guy responsible for just kind of doing the actual footwork to make things go through.
Yes, and this is when people talk about not liking how the sausage is made in politics. This is the ugly, bloody, gooey, nasty part. You need to get to a number. You need to talk to these people, and you need to push whatever button you need to push to make sure that they are going to vote a certain way.
So if you have, let's say, Senator Justin Robert Young,
yes,
and I need his vote for my chimpanzee emancipation proclamation, you know,
absolutely,
my you know, primates get full rights, whatever kind of position, and I need him to sign off on that, I'm going to say, well, you know, you represent, you know, how you got elected to represent, you know, your town and, you know, your area in Northern California, I have no idea. But I understand that, you know, you want to put in a big solar farm and you need some federal funds. And I'm the guy that'll go in and say, so-and-so is willing to say yes on that. If you say yes to my harebrained scheme.
Yeah.
And so he's the guy that goes in and he's kind of goes behind the scenes, makes those deals, do that stuff. And it's a very interesting position. So the House of Cards features Kevin Spacey plays the guy who has that job, and he gets screwed over. But he's a guy, I was going to put a joke out on Twitter, like, my favorite thing about this is there's no bad guys. implying that but he is a very complex, interesting guy doing whatever he can to get what he wants. Because when he feels like he's been betrayed by his party, he's like, screw you guys, I'm going to do what I need to do to get what I want. And it's a very interesting story. Very well thought of. Watched the first 13 episodes over a period of 2 days. Enjoyed it thoroughly. Thought it was very well acted. Thought it was very well done. I thought all the casting was good. Felt myself totally pulled into it. I enjoyed it more than some of the other critics. You know, it's got pretty good reviews, but I enjoyed it more than I think a lot of the other ones on there, and thought that it was consistently well done. So that's my pick, is House of Cards.
Okay. Now, if you would like to listen to the reason why, and I will say what I'll reveal afterward, the initial conversation I had with Andrew when we were initially talking about the funding coming in for House of Cards, that you can say afterward. But Andrew, let's, for all intents and purposes, there's gonna be nothing new except for what we just said we were going to talk about after this point. Let's go ahead and end the podcast. Go ahead and do the catchphrase, and then just keep listening if you want to listen to this other part.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Weird Things podcast. It's been weird.
All right. Everybody out? Good.
Yeah.
So however, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, when they make the announcement that Netflix has purchased the rights to House of Cards, you had seen House of Cards before that announcement was made. Right, you had watched it.
Yeah, I was already a fan of the British one before I even heard they're going to remake it. I mean, it was, you know, watched it, you know, probably a year or so before that came out that they were going to make this.
But there was an element to the ending for which rubbed you the wrong way. Do you remember how you initially phrased it at the beginning? And then I'm curious to know if you said that you may have gotten some of that wrong or misremembered it, right?
So. I you know, I was frustrated by the ending, and they're obviously not going to have the same ending here because it just couldn't happen. I was frustrated because the way it ended was, and I assume that House of Cards was going to follow a very similar track, given the people involved with it and their particular take on politics and stuff like that, and
yes.
You know, love Kevin Spacey, and I think that, you know, he's a great actor. I think that he does some great stuff, but. You know, they, you know, when they go get behind to go do a movie like Recount or whatever, you know,
they've made no bones about where they come from politically.
Yeah.
They come from a far left place politically.
And I think that's fine. I think that's totally valid. I think that can be, you know, I'm a guy that, like, I don't know what the hell I am each day, you know, whatever. But whenever I know, well, I know where they're going to go, you know,
I would prefer them. I think they are very upfront about their beliefs. You got to know where they're coming from, and it's not like they pretend to be anything else.
And it can be, absolutely, absolutely, you know, very entertaining. You know, Aaron Sorkin you know, as a guy, you know what his beliefs are, whatever. And you can go into that and say, okay, I'm going to be, this is going to be handed to me. And it can, you can be thoroughly entertained. I love the movie Dave, Didn't Like American President.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, he wrote both, and both kind of approach these things from different points of view. You know, West Wing, you know, some of the greatest television ever. So yeah. I have no problem with that, you know. But the ending of House of Cards, the British TV series, is that while you're watching this Machiavellian guy who's a Conservative Party or Tory, whatever, play out and play sort of the recognizable sort of villain and go about these sort of things, they build up the guy who's going to be the good guy, who's a Labor Party guy, kind of comes sort of out of nowhere and is like the one good man kind of thing, which is fine, great. But it was this, the British government's going through this financial crisis, and that guy comes in and he saves the day. Remember, this TV movie was made in 1990. He saves the day. British government's on the verge of like financial collapse. He saves the day by borrowing the money from the Soviet Union. And justifies, well, the Soviet bank, you know, they do deals in the Middle East and da-da-da, and that's sort of the justification for it. And I'm sitting there going, okay, wait. So you're borrowing money from the biggest human rights violator,
yes,
you know, up until that point, short of, let's say, China or whatever, one of those prolific, aggressive people on the world stage. You know, you could say that, you know, if you want to take a point of view, they're aggressive. You could say the United States is aggressive, but
they're still, you know, aggressive, yeah.
And they're sitting over, still at this point, still, you know, controlling large parts of Eastern Europe,
yeah,
you know, with under knife point, whatever. And you're going to go to them for the money. That's where you're going to go to get the money and justifying this is it. That one was fantastically, what the hell, and more, that they had the money to do,
yes,
that because they're on the verge of collapse. That was the thing that sort of like the idea that they were going to be able to bail out the British government. I'm like, what fantasy is this?
Yeah.
So.
So that was the frustrating element that I heard of immediately upon hearing that House of Cards was going to be a remade series from Netflix. And from the people who brought you Recount, you would think, or there was a thought that maybe it would follow along a similar line in this American reincarnation.
Yeah. So I was at, and I thought that, and I don't know, I have not read the books. The guy who wrote the books, Michael Dobbs, is a, because you would watch this and you would think that this was, you know, somebody from the Labor Party had created, because, you know, just the archetype that, but actually it was a Tory, not, you know, a Conservative Party member who wrote the book and all that and played that out, which, you know, shows that the very even hand of which he wanted to do that. But I don't know if that was the plot. I don't know if that was the final resolution in the book or not, but
gotcha.
Somewhere along the way, though, just the idea that was that, I was like, how could they have any money? You know, so that was just drove me nuts. That just drove, it was a little, that little sort of historical sort of thing, that's how the day gets saved. But it was a very entertaining series and I recommended it. So
now, politically, is the American House of Cards something that wears its politics on its sleeve, or is it more the inside baseball, ugly, you know, political machine kind of story?
You know, what they did, which I thought was a very, very wise choice, is the Kevin Spacey character. It's most of these machinations in the first series take place within the DNC. And what's good about that is that it's not, is whenever, most times when you see stuff, when, you know, movies or television involving politics, the conservatives are always going to be these backwards guys, Bible thumping, kind of mustache twirling, kind of classical cartoony, yeah, kind of villains. And here you have the main, we'll say, anti-hero.
Sure.
All this sort of takes place within, most of it takes place within that party. When you do get the token, I mean, it's funny because there's like, you'll see, they'll use like real political commentators and stuff and have them like George Stephanopoulos and whatever and use them, having them playing themselves and stuff.
Yeah.
But then when you get to the one, when you need to have a conservative commentator do it, they have a real cartoony version of Rush Limbaugh. Hard to imagine a more cartoon version of
exactly
him.
Yeah. A bit of a blowhard by himself.
They absolutely managed to do it somehow. And that was sort of thing, like, it's the one thing that feels so false was like, well, now you, it was just sort of weird, but any event, I think it was a smart choice, because then you're not going to be automatically thinking along those sort of whatever ideology you have, you know,
yeah,
which I think is a very good thing. I think you want to make yourself, you in telling a story, you want anybody to feel sympathetic to whoever's there, you know, whoever you're sort of following. And,
yeah,
and, you know, I, you know, I very much, I'm a person, I respect people who are compassionate and impassioned people who want to help and want to do these sort of things, and whatever they call themselves, I can be persuaded or, you know, root for them in some capacity, you know. But anytime one of my friends tells me they're running for office, any office, I disown them.
You know, it's a problem. It's a bad look. Yeah. Doesn't look good on anybody.
But I can tell you, I mean, I, following the pattern of where the British miniseries, I know where this is going to evolve to, and I'm sure I have an idea what is going to come about. But I would say that they handled things in a very good way. When you see some of the early on opponents like this, you go, oh, this is going to be good. They're not going to be drawing these cartoon characters of these are the good guys or these are the bad guys.
Yeah.
It's very, I thought so far, very well done.
Awesome. Well, there we go. Thank you for staying for the spoiler addendum of the Weird Things podcast. Goodbye, ladies and gentlemen.
You want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.